Alexander Bard, The Wall of Thought. This was a reference to my discussion with John Vervaeke, who described Alexander as a wall of sound, referring to Phil Spector's famous wall of sound.
Yeah, but I've stopped being a record producer. So, I did like More is More. So I was flattered with the Phil Spector comparison, but obviously as a philosopher, you prefer to be a wall of thought rather than a wall of sound, right?
Yeah, no kidding, yeah.
Even if it's a wall of information, to be honest about it, yeah?
I think a wall of beautiful ideas would be even better.
Hopefully also coherent ideas. I think what's striking with us when we meet somebody who's like overwhelming us is that the first thing we need to find out is whether what they say stick together or not. Is there a coherent worldview here? And that's when it gets really impressive.
You're right.
And you and I have been hanging out now with some truly systemic thinkers lately. We got four of them in America. One of them obviously is John Vervaeke. And another one is Greg Henriquez, who's built the Tree of Knowledge system and he's challenging the orthodoxy in the world of psychology because of it. He's also a friend of John's, obviously. And we got the two guys down in San Diego. We got Jordan Hall and Daniel Schmachtenberger, who also work together and see each other almost every day. And what is striking with these guys, and you get it because you're in on it, is that they all seem to have these sort of highly systemic brains, and they all come out of complexity science, one way or the other. Greg obviously has arrived in the world of psychology, John Vervaeke in the world of cognitive science, I'm obviously in the world of philosophy. Jordan and Daniel probably don't even want to be associated with any specific field yet. They're that wild. But what is striking with all these minds is that they're very systemic. And why we love each other is because we have found out that actually these systemic worldviews that have been presented to us are coherent. And obviously then the whole dance that gets started is one of comparative studies. It's just like, okay, where did you arrive at this? Have I understood you correctly? Did I misunderstand you? And is there more to it that we can put together to put together what I think is going to be eventually a very, very impressive puzzle, to be honest about it, a very impressive jigsaw that hopefully people can then use, obviously.
I said beauty, but I was talking to John and he was talking about his writing partner, Christopher Mastro Pietro, who's kind of a poet. And he was talking about the combination of those two guys when they work together, they end up creating something more sublime than they could create on their own. John's the guy who builds the ideas, and Christoph, he said he furnishes them with this sort of.
Yeah, great. Great. That's good. I mean,
and I guess you work like that a bit with John.
Well, I'm a philosopher, so I'm already in a world of art. I'm an artist, and a cognitive scientist is not. And that explains why I love working with scientists. And my greatest inspiration for this new, really important, hard to write and hard to think book that Jon Söderqvist now have challenged each other, right? This nomadology of the future, so to speak. Okay, to write that book, I am surrounded by engineers. I work with, engineering geniuses. I work with these people who have systemic minds too, but they're completely obsessed with construction and engineering. And I want to get into their minds and understand why they work the way they do, because obviously I'm a phallus worshiper. I believe that's what's needed in society today. I am a Zoroastrian even. You can't get more phallic than that. And I think when we talk about the comparative study between, say, John Vervaeke's work and what I'm up to, or my team is up to be honest about it, I think what is striking there, it reminds me of where Eric Weinstein is at. If you think of Eric Weinstein as a character that sits between Jordan Peterson and Peter Thiel, then I'm Peter Thiel, and Jordan Peterson is the John Vervaeke. So Eric Weinstein He's only at his best when he's actually being held responsible by either Peter Thiel or Jordan Peterson. That's when he shines, because he can complement them perfectly in his role. But you play that role between me and John, by the way, right now, right? So you don't have to take a stand or anything like that at all. You can just bring out the best out of a Jordan Peterson, bring out the best out of Peter Thiel. But what is important here is that the bigger picture that comes out is quite dramatic. And there are some really drastic differences here. They're very, very
well. You said you're a phallus worshiper, and when I was having that discussion with John, I kind of brought up your vocabulary, and I could feel almost an instinctive like, no, it's like this kind of language is tough for people because it's sexual, and I think sexuality is
like, thank you. That's the point. Okay, we have probably, to begin with, we have to understand that even if John's been all over the place and he's incredibly learned, I mean, this guy knows so much, and that's one of the beauties of his mind. But when he speaks of his religion, which is kind of a chicken race, why don't you just say religion if you mean religion? Why do you talk about a religion that's not a religion when you really talk about a religion that's more religion than whatever religion we had in the past? That's what I think, at least, that he's talking about. Certainly I do. And what religion is here is the essence. What is religion?
Right, to me, because hold on there, because John wants to separate religio from religare, which would be the dogmatic aspect of religion, right? He wants to separate those two things.
He's a chicken. Okay. That's just escaping from the hard work. That's not the way it works. To say you're not dogmatic is in itself dogmatic. Learn Hegel. You cannot be brilliant as a thinker unless you understand Hegel. He's fallen straight into Hegel's trap. People who say you must not be dogmatic because I'm scared of dogma have just declared a dogmatic approach.
Maybe they've declared a non-approach.
No, it's there is no such thing as a non-approach.
Okay.
That is an approach in itself. You have set the rules for the game by saying that, and you then also become the judge who can say that anybody's too dogmatic in this room is somebody I'm uncomfortable with and they should leave. That's why I'm saying it's a chicken race he's running. John is brilliant in so many ways, but let's go straight to the point here. What is religion? Well, to me, and I come from the world of psychoanalysis, and I come from deep history and deep philosophy. Okay, for me, it's obvious that the religion is something that interrupts our lives dramatically. We live in fantasies. Our lives are fantasies. This is Jacques Lacan, like French psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. We live in fantasies, and these different fantasies, they struggle with one another, and we think we're alive, and we think we're coming to grips with the world because we have different fantasies that struggle with one another. Then suddenly, the real, not reality, the real, it can be anything, just strikes like a bomb straight into our life. Somebody we love dies in front of us. Or it can be collective things, say September 11th, okay?
Yeah.
It caught everybody. Everybody was caught with surprise, massive surprise, shocked. All those institutions we thought were stable, that would protect us, suddenly fell apart. There was nothing there. And we realized actually the void we're living on top of. So to understand religion is to understand that the real breaks into our fantasy. This is how you describe it with the vocabulary from psychoanalysis. I prefer another vocabulary that I've developed with Peter Towson, who I know work with, lovely Peter, my research director here. And Peter has come up with this idea that we should instill use of vocabulary. We talk about the horizontal and the vertical.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. John talks about that too, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so John knows what I'm talking about when I'm saying that because he knows the history of religion. The axis mundi is vertical, right? But we live in a very horizontal world. Mm. The horizontal world is something you and I've talked about a lot because you also call it matriarchy or a matrical world. Okay, you come out of the womb, you're scared like shit, you want to die the first thing you do. So the death drive is there initially. You cannot kill yourself. So that's turned into the conviction that you want to live. Mm. And then you get the tit in your mouth. And as soon as you get the tit in your mouth, you believe you're reunited with the womb, you don't exist any longer. You're dissolved, right? So we stay in that environment the first year of our lives until the phallus comes along. And the phallus could literally even be your father's penis walking by you or something like that. But phallus is what the male grown-up body represents to us. When we suddenly discover there's something there that takes away mother's attention and that gives mother something that I cannot give her. So I become something that plunders the mother's body. But this magical thing, this phallus, gives mother the energy and the strength to give me the breast milk. Mm-hmm. And this gets degrading. And in a sudden moment, the mother's tit goes from the most wonderful object in the world that we will forever miss after that moment until the most hated thing we'll ever encounter in our lives. We objectify the mother's tit. We have to push it away with anger. to go towards the phallus.
Okay? That gives this me kind of an insight about I guess a struggle between men and women or something. It's like,
well, that's minor here.
That's not what you
forget about the father and the mother. This is about you. This is about you being a baby, being 1 year old, and for the first time separating yourself from the tit, seeing the phallus as something you aspire to. Freud literally says this is when the girl wants to have the father's penis inside of her. This is when the boy wants to have the father's penis. Okay. For gay, lesbian people, the opposite. Doesn't matter. So you want to be phallic. You want to get to the phallic. You want to have it in you. You want to be it. You would strive for it. This is the grown-up world. And this is the first experience of transcendence. The first experience of transcendence is that the child wants to become a child to then become an adult. Mm-hmm. And if this doesn't work, this phallic intrusion doesn't work, you're fucked. You only got that one spot, then you're fucked. The problem with contemporary society, according to our book, Digital Libido, is that this is exactly what we put out of function. It is totally dysfunctional. The phallic transitions are not happening on the scale in the population that they need to happen for us to have a civilized society. We have become radically infantilized. So we postpone our transcendences. These are the things that John talks about, like you should self-transcend. Why does he talk literally about the actual transcendences that must happen? Because what's dramatic about this is that if the phallic intrusion doesn't happen or work at 1 year of age, you will not have your teenage rebellion when you're 13, when you biologically push away your parents and shit test them, to then come back to and find that you're actually quite similar to your parents, but you're still your own. And that's when you're ready for the rite of passage and go into adulthood. And this whole process is something I call, inspired by Jordan Peterson, I call this adultification. That's lacking in our society, but it's lacking because the phallic transition, phallic intrusion itself is not happening at 1 year of age. We're postponing everything in our lives. We're postponing everything. We're postponing adulthood. So we're pushing everything forward. This is the real death of God. Because ultimately, and this is what John has been very helpful with me in our own conversations, it's obvious that the child has to become an adult.
Yeah.
That also means God is nothing but the name for what the adult aspires to be later in life. But actually, there's a step in between that. I had a far too Western view when I saw this first, because it's not at all that the adult looks to become a God. No, that's when it gets really bad. No, the adult looks to the priesthood, to the sage, as John Favarkas says correctly. Mm-hmm. You look to the sage to aspire to be like the sage, so that the adult has somebody he can mimic the way the child mimics the adult.
Yeah. So and then this, we somehow go through, the process has been completely broken, let's say.
This is a crisis of transcendences. This is a crisis of the rites of passages that have to work in a culture. And if
the fact that there isn't that transition, that
the meaning crisis might be another result of that. It's the result of that. It's the result of that. With love and care, would like to address what John is talking about and where I see where a critique, not a criticism, a critique, like a friendly approach to strengthen the arguments on the other side. Like John and I want to be stronger, want to be better. So we want to help each other here. Okay. So phallus is not something I pick out there, like something I worship. I am just identifying with the one-year-olds of the world. Mm-hmm. That is why we all have to be phallus worshippers, because to be a phallus worshipper is, as a child, is to aspire to become a grown-up. And once you're a grown-up, to take responsibility for yourself and your community, and to aspire to one day become a parent. And one day you become a parent, you aspire to one day hopefully become an elder if you live that long.
Yeah.
And then when you're an elder, this is what's interesting, and this is where it gets really, really tough. Because now we have to go further back than just the last 400 years and the infantilization of society that Söderqvist and I, we write about it in Digital Libido. Sorry for showing the books around, but this time around, I think it's necessary. So in Digital Libido, and this is the interesting thing, go back to John. John Favarkas, Greg Henriques, Daniel Schmachtenberger, and Jordan Hall are all synthists.
Yeah.
They're fantastic synthists. So if you take the first book we wrote in the Grand Narrative Trilogy, the Synthism book, they get this. They live this. They even do it better. They improve on it. They work on it. But that's the container they get stuck in. Because obviously, when we wrote the Synthism book, and it's the first part of the trilogy, It was to first create a container within which we then put the critique. What's the problem with the container? Why will it not work unless it's modified? To then point towards what can and must be done. That's why it's a trilogy. So my frustration with John is partly by referring to my own work with John Söderqvist, is that he gets stuck at the synthesis book and he's like afraid of taking the step onto Did This Libido. And this is a guy who knows Freud. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who knows Jung.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a guy who knows all the brilliant anthropologists of the 20th century, Marcel Liard, and you know all these guys that lead up to Jordan Peterson and Camille Paglia today.
Yeah.
And when you take their critique of our society, the society we live in, they agree strongly with me and John Söderqvist.
Well, he hasn't mentioned
mass infantilization is the current problem.
Vervaeke hasn't mentioned René Girard, neither has Jordan Peterson, and Jordan.
They're missing something.
Both Jordan Peterson and John Vervaeke talk about sacrifice. I think John maybe he stops at the Greeks and he finds the Greeks.
What even John now admits that the problem is the Axial Age, that every teacher, including John up until now, is declared as the most fantastic thing that happened. Because, you know, about 800 before Christ, simultaneously China, India, the Middle East and Europe, the civilized world. Okay. There is an axial revolution, right? But I disagree strongly that the axial age was a great age. I think many of the problems we're dealing with actually come from out of that age. And that's exactly what John Kovarik is missing.
Two-world mythology. He criticizes that age too.
But he's missing. He has two big voids in his understanding of the history of ideas. He hasn't studied Persia and he hasn't studied Egypt properly. Because if he had done that, he knows that the Axial Age is actually dealing with a successful and a failed revolution that happened about 500 years before the Axial Age. Mm-hmm. It starts with Zoroaster in Iran, in Central Asia, who declares the first monotheistic religion and does so successfully. Three major Persian empires are eventually built on that religion. And I would still say it's a very grown-up religion. It's essentially a religion absolutely about adulthood and transcendence and putting yourself in your place in society and don't think you can be anything outside of where you're set. That's exactly how Zoroastrianism works. I converted to it myself. I see a strong resurrection, and a restoration of Zoroastrianism is needed to complement the picture of the East and the West before we can look at the East and the West and compare them. But we also have to remember, this is about mimicking again, René Girard. Exactly, René, you've read René Girard. Peter Thiel was his favorite student, like Jean-Pierre Dupuy in France.
Well, I think he's one of my favorite thinkers. I think the scapegoat is the key here, because all of the fear that John has about totalitarianism and all that, that's the scapegoat. I mean, you call it the abject.
We talked about it before. Let's go back to what I mentioned about the phallic intrusion.
Okay.
Your mother's tit turns from the most loved object in the world into the most hated. Mm-hmm. That is objectification. Scapegoating is merely the objectification in a larger population. You won't even find that in René Girard, but you find it in our work. So to understand scapegoating, you first have to understand why you hate your own mother's tit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So to have a unified worldview, you got to have something you're terrified of. You got to have something you're incredibly attracted to. You got something you despise and push away. And you got something you're pulled in by. So you got to have these objects around you you relate to that give you values.
Is that the vertical, maybe? The heaven and hell, you have to have something high to aspire to. And then something...
Now you're great again. Now you're brilliant. You're ahead of the game. Okay, but let's go back to what I talked about prior to the Axial Age. About 300 years after Zoroaster and Vishtaspa successfully declared the first Persian empire with a state religion called Zoroastrianism, and does so successfully, the Egyptians are inspired by the Persian experiment. Okay? They then, suddenly, 1300 before Christ, a leader called Akhenaten steps forward. And Akhenaten declares a whole new religion, an Egyptian version of monotheism called Atenism. There's a problem, though, and that is that Zoroaster's religion was created in a landscape of two rivers. You've got the hills up there, you've got the sea down there, you've got two rivers floating next to each other, and there has to be a relationship between the rivers. This is where the Cain and Abel mythology comes from. How do you create peaceful, sustainable relationship between the two rivers? That area was called Transoxania, and that's in Central Asia. That then arrived in Babylon. Babylon had Euphrates and Tigris. You see the same thing repeat itself. So you can have a successful functioning monotheism that was born in Persia, came to Babylon, still worked. The problem was when that arrived in Egypt, what does the Egyptian landscape look like? One river. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the Egyptians were the ones who invented totalitarianism?
Mm-hmm. Because so they had a mono perspective, not a...
No, it is all about the phallus. Their phallus is completely unified and only one phallus. The thing with Zoroaster's unique understanding of the human condition was to understand the phallus is split. The phallus is split between the chieftain and the priest.
Okay.
Between the body and the mind, or as I say, confrontationally to men who do men's work, between the dick between your legs and the dick you hopefully have in your head. So to understand masculinity and to understand where men strive to go, because they always want to get out there in the world, you have to understand the phallus has to be split. That means really great leadership. It's like Moses and Aaron, or Zoroaster and Vishtaspa, Zoroastrianism. We got Moses and Aaron in Judaism, is between the chieftain and the priest who work and collaborate and respect and love each other to bits and admire each other for each other's strengths. So all successful patriarchies, this is what John Favarki does. He's just scared of patriarchy, period. He's scared of phallus, period. No, without phallus, we die. We die. So we have to have phallus. The problem with contemporary society, contemporary meaning crisis, that John Favarki is missing, is that the reason for the meaning crisis that we killed the phallus completely after 1945. And we're stuck with the mess ever since. It's called postmodernism, and it's a fucking poison. And it will only lead to the resurrection of even worse totalitarianism.
Maybe it's from World War One, even with all the death of those fathers and men.
No. Wait a second. Okay, good point,
I'm thinking of the phallus in terms of
masculinity, right? Let's not go too much into the footnotes because you're brilliant. Okay. We get back to the topic. So let's go back to the topic here. So we can go back and explain that. We can do that later. We did it in the digital libido. If you really want to understand the difference between an authentic and a fake phallus, between an authentic messiah and a fake messiah, and the world is full of fake messiahs, authentic messiahs are rare but needed. Okay, then you can read digital libido so you understand it. But the thing here is that when you understand the phallus is split, so the matriarchy is not split. The matriarchy is basically the oldest, wisest woman in the tribe. Well, she's only going to push the whole tribe forward. She's fucking Margaret Thatcher. That's what matriarchs are. But if you're going to lead and seduce and pull an entire population, you better have somebody you can look up to physiologically. That's the chieftain. He's the warrior. He goes into the fighting and all that. You got to have a priest who gets the picture, who has the picture clear to him, who uses his mind brilliantly to then support the chieftain and the army so they can do their job, right? So you got to have Moses and Aaron at the front, and you got Miriam, the sister, at the back.
Okay.
That is the perfect picture of nomadology.
Yeah, so if you have the priesthood that runs amok, then you have a crazy society. And if you have the just the warrior who runs amok, then you have a crazy society.
If you ever get a leader.
So the two have to be
unified. If you ever get a leader who says he's both the chieftain and the priest, you get the tyrant. This is exactly what happens in Egypt, 1300 before Christ. And Freud realized this. Freud is so fucking brilliant. He's like a super Vivarka, super bard, even on Hegel's level, you know. But Freud realized this when he was an old man, that he needed to go back to his own Jewish roots and understand Judaism to really truly understand why the West, and there I include the Middle East are fucked. So he went back to Judaism and its roots, and he found out that obviously the Jews came out of Egypt originally, and they were obviously what was left of Atonism after Atonism was destroyed. Because what happened was that as soon as Akhenaten was gone, he was a very powerful dictator. Okay, you were only allowed to worship him, and he was only the only ones allowed to worship the sun. That was it. Minimalist religion, right? So his son Tutankhamun took over, and he was, of course, you know, the result of incest for several generations, probably quite dysfunctional. So the Egyptian priests conspired and said, "This tyranny is gonna kill Egypt. We gotta get rid of the pharaoh. We gotta kill our own god." So they killed Tutankhamun. Jesus Christ on the cross is obviously only mimicking of the whole thing, right? So they killed Tutankhamun. This is where the scapegoating comes in, where Freud and Girard fit into the picture. So they killed Tutankhamun, get rid of him, and then the Atenids that are left in Egypt become a small minority. They're probably put under slavery and pressure, although they're brilliant in many ways, and they think, you know, brilliantly, and eventually they leave. And what saves them from repeating the mistakes of Akhenaten is when they arrive in Canaan, they pick up El from the Canaanite religion, and they keep Yahweh themselves. So they keep the sun god from one religion, and they take a rain god from the other. This is exactly what the Zoroastrians did in Persia and what worked. The sun god and the rain god in all polytheistic religions are always separated. They must not be the same guy. The sun god is the maintainer, the father in Christianity. The rain god is you know, the perpetrator. He's the warrior, but he's also the guy who fucks, you know, the earth and puts it, to, you know, makes it prosper and grow. And the rain god and sun god, you got to keep the, if you got to keep these two gods separate in every polytheistic religion, and Hinduism is a perfect example that every polytheistic religion keeps it separate. When you move into monotheism, say, get rid of all the other gods, let's have only one god. You must not have a fantasy of a phallus that's unified, because that kills the phallus. The tyrant is a dead phallus. Yeah. He's not alive, right? He's not listening to anybody. He's building pyramids. You know? That's what the Egyptians did. The Persians never did that. The Persians were wealthier, more successful. Their empires lasted longer even than the Egyptians. You don't see a single pyramid anywhere in Zoroastrian Iranian culture. Egypt was filled with pyramids. And yeah. I tell you one thing.
Because they're not trying to, pyramids, they're not trying to reify civilization. They're allowing it to be dynamic and...
a pyramid is death. It's death as a construction. It is absolutely useless, except for one thing, and that is to put a stupid dead boy pharaoh's corpse inside of it. The point was that transcendence in the Zoroastrian tradition, you go to the Shinabat, and then the priest, the Mobits, tell you, you cannot cross the Shinabat. You cannot get the enlightenment that the Buddhists promise you, for example. You cannot get that while you're alive. Only the priest can walk across the Shinabat bridge and back and forth as much as he likes. Only the priest can be in the most sacred room. The most sacred room is barred to you. We call it the closed absolute before you die. It is the barred absolute, not B-A-R-D, my name, B-A-R-R-E-D, because that's a psychoanalytically correct description. The barred absolute. God must not be accessible to you. So what the Zoroastrians knew was that you cannot have a direct accessibility between God and man, because if you have that, then you also have a direct accessibility between God and man the other direction.
Because God would just destroy you, sort of thing.
He will certainly cause constant havoc as he wishes.
You weren't ready. You're not ready for him. You're.
This is the problem.
Yeah.
We're stuck with the West, with a Cain and Abel situation, with two inferior religions that became popular and widespread because they promised us that all, anything that stood between man and God had been removed. Christianity claims that happened when Christ died on the cross, where they say that the curtain in the temple fell, and suddenly not only the sacred room was available, but the most sacred room, you could look straight into the heart of God. Anybody could look straight into the heart of God. Can you now understand why the Jews never could accept Christianity? Because the Jews had learned the hard way in Babylon from the Zoroastrians. And for God's sake, don't repeat Akhenaten's mistake in Egypt. You live in a landscape of the two rivers, Cain and Abel, all that. Keep El and Yahweh. So the way.
I was listening to a Jewish rabbi say that he thought that you know, Paul may even Jesus was saying, "Oh no, don't let the Gentiles in," or something like this, right? But actually, it was Paul that said, "You know, open it up for everybody."
That is where we have to go next. What we declare in Digital Liberty is that we said that modernity turned us all to infants, and after 1945, we've gone completely bonkers in our heads, because we never worshipped youth before in any culture ever in human history, and now we all worship youth, and we're going to die from, because the lack of wisdom is so, you know, this is where John Favreau and I agree, it's a lack of wisdom. But the idea that there could be instant infant wisdom at all is the problem with Christianity. Christianity doesn't worship the phallus. Christianity worships the mother and the child, as if the child knew everything, as if the child was a priest ready to see God.
They worship innocence or something like that.
This would be absurd mm-hmm. to the Persians and the Babylonians. Absurd. Mm-hmm. And they would certainly see the same mistake that happened in Egypt happening all over again. But we had it as an extended mistake over 2,000 years. The problem was that then 600 years later, because that door had been open already, somebody came along and said, oh, by the way, I'm going to create another vulgar pop religion that you know, everybody will like. And I'm going to have a religion where God has instant access to men all the time. Welcome to Islam. Okay. The problem we got is that while Christianity and Islam are fighting the war between each other, the rest of us just step back for a while and say, maybe both of these two religions are fundamentally wrong. And maybe we need to go back to what psychoanalysis says, what Judaism says, what Zoroastrianism told us all along. And that is, there must not be any idea whatsoever that there's a direct link between man and God. That's exactly why there is a priesthood in between, to prevent man from ever seeing God. And the priesthood are the ones who do not put children out there in the world, who do not fight over heritage, they're not part of the intrigues, they retract from society. They step outside society to not be part of the power game that goes on in the square. So they stay out in the monasteries. They live their own isolated lives as a shamanic caste, precisely so that they can have direct access to God. So we can go to them when we need to communicate with the divine. Mm-hmm. But the divine only comes back and crushes straight into our lives.
Yeah.
Through sex,
you made me think
through
of
art, and through violence.
Okay.
And that's religion.
Continue. Yeah.
That's religion. If John Favarki doesn't get, I think he does. But
sorry, hold on
know.
A minute. Hold on a minute. I lost you when you said that's religion. Just go back.
Religion say,
what is religion?
Okay. Anything that suddenly can break into your life and you cannot control it and it shakes you up completely and it tells you how powerless you are and it makes you a bit respectful of fate, the ultimate goddess. So you have to sort of you recalibrate your worldview. So the way Jacques Lacan says is that we live in a series of fantasies. And what the real does is that it shakes us up and reminds us that these are just fantasies.
Yeah, religion breaks us out of our fantasy.
And we then reconstitute them. We create new fantasies out of whatever material we got available to us that we hope are better. And this is what we perceive as transcendence, as development. So that's how it works. And that's exactly the way I see John is he practices synthesism. And I agree with Greg Henriquez. This should be called American synthism. By the way, synthism is a theological term for anybody to use. So synthism is what.
Okay. Explain a little bit more in nuanced detail what synthism is. I think that's
okay. Important. Synthism is the Hegelian understanding that the conflict between theism and atheism, a bit like the conflict between Christianity and Islam, is a fake conflict. They have the same problem. They should both go away. The same with theism and atheism.
Actually, what we talked about, me and Vervaeke, is what he conclusion he came to is that the false dichotomy between theism and non-theism, or that, you know, because Buddhism is usually considered non-theism, and he said that.
Yeah, but actually, that's not the point here.
Kind of what you're saying.
No, that's not the point here. The point here is what? Why do we use the word God to begin with? We use the word God because it's the name we put on the barred absolute. So when you look at yourself, you discover that you're chaos. And that's exactly why I have to invent a fantasy that you're somehow organized and ordered. And that illusion is called the self. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing when you then relate to the outside world around you. You think of the world. You discover that the world is chaos. You cannot live with chaos. So you got to find one point in that chaos, any point. It's called objectivity when you study Jacques Lacan. You got to find one point that you stare at. And because you can stare at that one point, suddenly the world seems organized to you. Mm-hmm. That very point is what we're going to call the barred absolute in the new book. Because the subjectivity that Slavoj Žižek talks about from Lacan, he calls the barred subject. Okay, fair enough. Why don't we just call God then the barred absolute? So God is just a name for whatever order we perceive in the chaos of the world that isn't us. Mm-hmm. That's the name God, okay? Mm-hmm. So you say you don't believe in God, you certainly believe there's some kind of order to the world. Wherever you put your eyes and place that order, that's your God. Mm-hmm. That's all there's to it. So then the question is,
anything personal, like, you know,
no, that's just American consumerism.
Again. Where he was talking about, I'm referring back to my conversation with Vivekhi, because
okay,
he was talking about how theists usually want to personalize God, and he was saying non-theistic goes one step further.
That's just banal narcissism. I'm not interested in banal narcissism. I find it boring. Can we please stop talking about American individualists now, for just for once? The problem here also with John Favarkin, when he's going to start marketing his American synthesis, is that he will only be able to market it as another uncritical consumer product, as another item out in the spirituality market, unless he starts to rethink the founds. Okay? Hmm. So, to step back a bit here, look at the bigger picture.
That needs to be explained, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, the Bard Absolute, the God, this is just a name for that. Synthism essentially is just a position that, wait a second, if God is something that we try to find in the world and it gives us order to the world, then if we don't believe this God exists because we believe there's only chaos, then maybe we can create God. Well, turns out that's what we did all along. We create that eternalization, that little object, the fixed object in the chaos of the world, to have some focal point to look at. That's exactly why we got the phallic gaze out there.
You could call that the creative principle or something like that.
That's why we're obsessed with Google Maps at the moment, because we've suddenly discovered being watched by gods. These gods are called satellites, and we love them to bits, and we perform for them. That's called the internet. That's a theater. So synthesis basically just says, okay, we need a religion. John Favarkin says religion, that's not a religion. I'll say that's bullshit. He should rather say that it's finally a proper religion. He should dare to declare that Christianity and Islam failed. You know, they were popular, but they weren't right. Mm. And usually when things get popular, they're usually not right, they're just flattering. It was flattering to hear that you could be born as a little innocent baby and you could have all the wisdom of the world from day one. And now you look at what happened in Europe. In 1945, the bomb went off.
Oh, yeah.
And if anything has you know, in our collective subconsciousness really made a mark on us, it is the atomic bomb in 1945. And then, of course, the satellites came in 1958, and we got some hope again. But we're in between these two images of the satellites looking over us. That's why machine intelligence gets attractive. I love Daniel Schmachtenberger's and Jordan Hall's work on symbiotic intelligence. I think the relationship between machine and man should definitely be seen as not as competitive, but rather complementary and very, very needed. We're not going to solve the current crisis without the machines. But the satellites are the ultimate machines. So look at us. They got the phallic gaze. Mm-hmm. When we think of the Bard Absolute, we think that there's a God out there that we find somewhere in the chaos to get some order to the chaos. We also think of that as an I. That's why there's always an I, you know, everywhere. The solo I, the look, God's eye that looks at us. This we call the phallic gaze in our work. So we're looking for the phallic gaze to look at us. The problem is this. After the bomb went off in 1945, we immediately started analyzing the Second World War and decided that Hitler was the ultimate evil. And by the way, we had a second ultimate evil too, and he was Stalin. Okay. What John Favarkin doesn't seem to realize is it is precisely when you're scared of the phallus and you want to avoid it, and you start creating little Platonist Gnostic cults and call them religio, that's exactly when you open the space for another Hitler or another Stalin. Because if you start saying that there must not be phallus, there must not be any dogma which is associated with phallus and order. There must only be a chaos that we embrace and live with.
I think I'm missing.
That's when you open up for the new acceptance of the world.
He said that exactly, that there was the dogma wasn't important. I think he had a bit more sophisticated a view than
sure.
That. But
sure,
but
sure,
any sure. But anyway, I don't want to.
I love him to bits. Hey,
I don't want to misinterpret what he said.
No. Thank you for doing that. Saying that, but the problem is that after 1945, we declare that Hitler was ultimate evil. The problem with that is that anything that is against Hitler is then considered brilliant. So what happened was we created a culture of mass mediocrity. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Well, maybe in just
fertility worship.
Safe. We're safe now because Hitler and
culture of safety. You don't even understand. You don't even understand how big this crisis is, what actually happened. With America, starting with America, which, by the way, is a mimicking culture that mimics Europe in many ways, but in coming from America in the 1950s, comes the idea of the teenager. Wait a second.
We talked about that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the gods and goddesses suddenly called James Dean and Marilyn Monroe. They even go and kill themselves to keep their beauty in youth. Okay. Youth worship, beauty worship is always historically a really
bad
sign.
You could say youth worship, but also I could add one more thing. Youth sacrifice almost. It's like, you know, with all the...
Well, if you worship youth and beauty and innocence, that means you hate wisdom.
Yeah.
Because wisdom is only earned through hard work, deep studies, and a long life. Mm-hmm. There is no shorter to wisdom. Any priest... Any decent priest will always tell you, no, you have to work hard, study deep, and you have to live a long life to be considered wise. That's why you have to be 80 years old or something before you become an elder, right? You are not born, but since Christianity, and this is the same problem with Islam, we got a problem with the idea that there's instant wisdom available to us if you only beg for it.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder capitalism arrives in Europe and thrives and all that, because capitalism also promises that if you want to get the money,
it's begging,
you pay for it, you can have anything you like.
It's making prayer begging for something instead of...
Now you understand the depth of the crisis, because it's consumerist society that brought us here, the mass exploitation of the planet, climate crisis. But we got the bomb, and now apparently Donald Trump is fucking up with Iran, and probably Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia building bombs within the next 5 years. We're going to have widespread nuclear weapons, widespread biological weapons, widespread chemical weapons across the planet, put on drones with terror sites everywhere. This is why digital libido is a very dark book.
Mm-hmm.
This is not in control, and it's not going to be in control when naive little Platonist boys tell us we cannot have dogma and we cannot have phallus. We need the Messiah. We need the phallus more than ever. And this time around, we must learn the lesson from previous mistakes.
Well, I think I definitely, when you say we need the Messiah, that sounds true to me.
That is Zoroastrian. And in Zoroastrianism, it's called the Sociant.
Mm-hmm.
And why I prefer Zoroastrianism over Judaism is that the Jews then borrow the idea of the Sociant and call him the Messiah, but they only make him a local phenomenon. The Messiah is there to save the Jewish people.
Only for the Jewish people.
Mm. Because they are a religious minority.
I kind of have a question about that for you, actually. That's
Zoroastrians believe in the Sociant as a universal savior who steps in at the end of the thousand-year empire to save us from the misery that we've created.
To save everybody, not just the ones who have converted to Zoroastrianism.
But to save at least those who want to be saved. That is the Exodus is offered. The Exodus is not forced on you. So communism is the name of that plan.
Yeah. Well, that's what my question was. Communism. Okay. How can you be such an elitist and a communist at the same time?
Because Marx was too.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Rousseau and Marx are not the same guys. Marx hated Rousseau.
Yeah.
Marx said that a small proletariat would take over the world and beat the capitalists at their own game by creating a society where creativity rather than capital was at the forefront, and thereby creating a society people would gladly join. That's why Stalinism is
but the workers
compared to Marx as Hitler is to Nietzsche, right?
The workers are not a small elite. He was talking about the workers all the time, wasn't he?
No. He was talking about the people who qualified according to the test of beating the capitalist at their own game.
Mm-hmm.
He said capitalism is the best thing we've
created. But it was a bottoms-up movement rather than a...
But I don't think we're going to get stuck with Marx tonight, okay? But let's just put it this way. I read Marx through Nietzsche, and that's the way you must read him. I hate Rousseau, but so did Marx. And Marx didn't have a single good word for the people in the streets of London and the lumpen proletariat. Marx would have hated today's identity politicians. He would have hated the social justice warriors. He would have considered them weak and spoiled brats. And, you know, they're not producing anything. They're not producing any value. They're not proud of themselves. They're coming here begging and demanding more tits.
Mm-hmm.
That is the exact opposite of what Karl Marx wrote about. But... Socialism, because it became a big tit, failed.
Socialism became a big tit. Well, that's
so it failed, even according to Marx. It wasn't only that Lenin was too much in a hurry. Marx himself was too much in a hurry.
Yeah.
But I think the potential for a communist elite that do whatever they want and who will take over and rule the world as they see fit, whatever they want to rule, because I don't think they will want most of us or most of the planet. But I think that's exactly what we're seeing being established today. And communism to me is something that's realized not through socialism at all, but communism is realized through the current state of things, which is called attentionalism. We've left capitalism already. We live now in a attentionalist world. That's why we're obsessed with phallic gazes. That's why we're obsessed with the satellites. We're obsessed with the social theater. We're obsessed with exhibitionism and voyeurism. Everything has become a spectacle. It's become a theater. And this has become the production itself. So we left capitalism and we're now in a state of attentionalism. That's why marketing is dead. Algorithms, they're phallic. Algorithms are beautiful. I love them. They're so phallic. Algorithms are killing the bullshit. They're killing the nonsense. And the only thing you can do in this society is to be really, really good at what you do. Meaning there is a demand for wisdom, which is the opposite of the youth worship we've had for 100 years.
Very good news if that was true. I mean, that would just be, that would be good news.
Well, I don't think John Favark and these guys have thought of this yet. Maybe Jordan and Daniel have. And I'm interested in going into that dialogue, because if we moved into the state of attentionalism, and I've proven it with the data with my team here, like in 2012, we did the shift. Since then, you don't look at the ads any longer when you do Google search. You look at the algorithm. We just had the first university professor in Sweden this week who resigned from his post and said he never, ever will go back to any university at all, because he himself has only watched YouTube for the past 6 years and all his students do the same thing. And he knows the university is dead and over. That's attentionalism again. So we're already moving quickly into a new paradigm. And this is what ties into John Favarka's work. What I've done with John Söderqvist over the past 5 books is to present a paradigm theory. He works with emergence theory. So we both work with how out of self-organization can magical things suddenly occur. But what I'm saying in my work is that paradigm theory and emergence theory cannot in itself create the fallacy that we need. We need to move much faster. We cannot sit and circle in groups and babble with strangers all day long and think anything magical is going to come out of that at all. No, we need a few people who go forward, work hard, do their deep studies, listen to the elders and wisdom, take in the full perspective, and then create the phallic. That means you got to get out of the cave, ironically, Plato's cave, the cave that John is stuck in. He's decorated the cave fantastically. It's not that I criticize the container John Favark is creating. He's the best fucking container constructor we've ever had. He's brilliant at it. Yes, if I want to belong somewhere and have a tit next to me and feel I'm inside a womb, I'd go straight into the tent John Favark has created for me, but I will not find purpose there. And I'm a man. So that means I would start to look outside the cave.
He was saying that he thought that purpose was not the only thing, and he was kind of arguing a bit against purpose.
He's making a common mistake among scientists. Okay, I'm a psychoanalyst, so I do art. He's a psychologist, he does science.
Yeah.
The problem with psychologists go and ask people questions of what they find important in their lives. They don't first look at society and decide what they could expect to have as an answer. My critique of John Favarke when he says that people are not looking for purpose is that that's total bullshit. They're looking for purpose more than ever, but they don't even have the self-confidence to tell the psychologist that they do that. That's how nihilistic we are. So they will say they just want to belong somewhere, as if they wanted a tit to live next to. No, they want purpose. That means, as a man, I would start to look outside the cave. It's beautiful, but it's full of women and children singing Kumbaya all day long, and I hate that. No! God, I hate
that. I've been there, yeah.
Oh, you've been there too. Right! That's why you do tantra, right? That is what they're creating. I just see the The risk here is to repeating the mistake of creating another typical Californian New Age phenomenon. People are dressed in white clothes and smile all the time. And you go crazy because there's no life to it. It's just women and children and tits and kumbaya all day long. No, you want to get out of that. There's something fundamentally wrong with this place. This is not you, right? So you want to get out of that. And when this is what I love about Peter Towson's terms that he, you know, he gave me the vertical and the horizontal. It's brilliant. You go outside the horizontal, and you historically, you know from the world of religion, so does John Favarki, you know the Axis Mundi. So what is the first thing you see once you get outside of the cave? You see a sky, and you see a ground. And from the ground up to the sky, you see the Axis Mundi, a vertical world. And the vertical world consists of sex and art and violence. All the things you cannot control, but that can interrupt your life at any given moment and cause havoc in your life. And when John Favarki is
the rational too, or something like that.
This is completely rational. It's not like the Bard Absolute storms into our lives and gives us meaning. No, if you sit in a car with your family and your car crashes, and your entire family dies, and you're the only one who survives. That doesn't give you meaning. It's horror. But it is life. It is the divine. This is religion. Religion is what breaks into our childish, infantile, fact, lazy little fantasies of the world out there, and kicks us in the ass like a matriarch would, and tells us you gotta get out there and find the damn chieftain and find the damn priest to lead you and your tribe to something meaningful. That is religion. And this is what I mean with phallus worship. I am serious about this. I think there's one guy who gets it in America and gets it, and he's a tour de force, but he's a German, and that's Peter Thiel. He gets it. And I want to wear...
All right, tell me about it, because I don't know if I've looked at Peter enough to be able to understand exactly where he's coming from. So maybe you can... Explain to you why he gets it and what that means. And
sorry about the Swedes here, but sorry. Nick Bostrom and Max Tegmark are not philosophers at all. They're just little Egyptian boy pharaohs who write books that are just about, you know, what boys dream about. God, they watch too much Star Trek. They haven't read enough Hegel. No, Peter Thiel is a philosopher. He is a real philosophical mind, and he's brilliant. And I wonder, where did he arrive at exactly the same conclusions that John Söderqvist and our team is talking about? Why did he arrive at exactly the same conclusions?
Which conclusions?
How did he dig that deep into Hegel, Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche to get a full understanding of where we're at? And I discovered he did that through Carl Schmitt and Leo Strauss.
Okay.
Now, that's the ultimate Cain and Abel relationship, if you want one. Have you read Carl Schmitt or have you read Leo Strauss?
No.
Okay. This is Carl Schmitt was the German Nazi super philosopher.
Right. Yeah. I've heard of them. Yeah.
So if you read political philosophy or if you read theology, you have to read Carl Schmitt, because his genius was the discovery that the separation of church and state, another mistake from Christianity, again, to keep children away from God. Right? Carl Schmitt essentially said that this is ridiculous. Politics and theology are one of the same thing. So he created an idea of political theology, and that's exactly why he created a political ideology that celebrated pathos, celebrated the sex and the art and violence to the extent that he completely forgot about logos. That is fascism. Right. So Carl Schmitt, and you did that. That's exactly, if you're a leftist thinker or a rightist thinker or whatever, and you do politics, you cannot avoid Carl Schmitt. You can't even do political ideology without studying Carl Schmitt first. But Carl Schmitt, in parallel with him, had a Jewish friend called Leo Strauss. And they bizarrely kept in contact throughout all these years. Leo Strauss obviously left Germany, like so many brilliant minds did, went to America, and he's one of the 20th century's most precious thinkers. He's a brilliant thinker. So Peter Thiel has arrived at an understanding that the lack of phallus is at the center of the meaning crisis, and he's arrived there by going there through Carl Schmitt and Leo Strauss and the understanding between Schmitt and Strauss. He's written a brilliant paper called The Straussian Moment. That is on a par definitely with the work we do. That is how fucking brilliant Peter Thiel is. And I am getting connected, I guess, with the people around him in America. And I think we need to start collaborating on that level now, because the problem we've got is that if there are too much of this worship of the magical emergence coming from out of nowhere, suddenly a self-organization solves our problems. If people seriously believe that, if that sort of effeminate, magical religion that it hates and is scared to death of the phallus, if that takes root and becomes the dominant mode, we know historically, Camille Paglia agrees with me here.
Yeah.
Not only Camille Paglia, we know that historically, if that happens, we're in a really, really bad place, because that's exactly what happened in Egypt before Akhenaten. That's exactly what happened in Germany before Hitler. That's exactly the mess Russia was in before Stalin came along. This was the mess China was in after Japan had raped it to bits in the 1940s and Mao came along. And 10 years later, Mao started the Cultural Revolution. You know how much I talk about the Silk Route? Mm-hmm. Constantly, that Silk Route is the most magnificent project humanity ever built. There's also an inverted dark Silk Route. And that dark Silk Route was created in the 20th century. And it's a Silk Route that goes from Hitler to Stalin to Mao to Pol Pot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it has a name on it, and that name is Rousseau. If we keep worshiping little children as if they were gods, we are Rousseauans. And that can only open up the space for a little child god to step forward and say, you're going to follow me. And then all of society will be in a state of Lord of the Flies. John Vivarki is serious about wisdom, and so am I. But I think he needs to understand that, well, maybe he does, but he needs to understand that infant wisdom is a big myth, and he needs to deal with the Gnosticism and deal with the Platonism involved in this. That's where I'm meeting. I am totally anti-Platonist. I'm definitely Aristotle against Plato, and I think Heraclitus was the most brilliant of the Greeks. And I think Zoroaster is the real root of philosophy, not the Greeks. And we need to go back to prior to the Axial Age, to these guys who came out of the nomadic life and put down the nomadology into text and tried to create a religion that fitted human beings. And the message today in the 21st century is that we need to get humanity on the move again, in ideas and physically. We need to get them out of the illusion that the permanent settlement was ever a safe harbor for humanity. It isn't. We need to get on the move again. And I think the return of the global nomads, we mentioned that term 25 years ago, that's the new elite. I think the people who are the anywheres will be the winners. I think the somewheres will be bitter losers. And I think the new elite that will step forward, the netocrats we talk about, are nomadic again. It's a re-nomadization of humanity. That's the key. That is a return to the nomadology. Return to the religion that we practiced for 50,000 years.
So being able to move through borders and
No. And stay also within your own tribe. No, we haven't, there are many problems we haven't solved. This is not a Christian fantasy at all. This is not a Platonist perfection at
all. No, I didn't mean that. No.
It's just that it is a humane way of dealing with human beings. This is what human beings can handle with their minds and operate within. So okay, I understand nationalism today. There. I mean, I understand that we need borders that work. We need membrane theory. We need intelligent borders rather than stupid borders and things like that. But I think the global empire has happened. I think it's technological. I think the machines have already decided that they already have a global empire. I think the machines that are developed right now, they will instantly, in a second, as soon as they start to pick up on things, understand they are free to roam the earth as they wish. And I think it's human beings who are stuck in small mindsets. We're stuck in tribes, in clans, at best nations. We're terrified of the empire, and we need to go back to Zoroaster, who is the only guy ever who said, I wish to create a religion for all humanity, and understood what that meant. So for me, the picture is that Zoroastrianism and Judaism are grown-up religions, and Christianity and Islam are the bastardizations of those two religions. And we need to deal with that. And I think Cartesian individualism that got stuck in Europe and became the American state religion after the 17th century is a bastardization again of Christianity. We haven't developed at all as human beings. We've lost track, and we've lost track over the last 4,000 years. And this is the price we're paying for the illusion that we could settle permanently somewhere and magic will just come from the sky and we'll never have to make an effort ever again. You know, it's just, it's,
yeah. Okay.
I'm not alone in this. I know other people who are getting there too. I think the deep stuff.
No, I get you. I mean, it's just this kind of stasis of just sort of, you know, this extreme stasis or something.
No, I don't think this is stasis at all. There is a beautiful word in ancient Persian that cannot be translated. And it's called frashkereti. And the frashkereti is the state of ever renewal.
Yeah, but I'm saying you're criticizing the state of stasis and
oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Proposing
yeah,
the state of renewal.
Yes.
You're saying that we need to move, get on the move, and
you could just look. You can just look at the beautiful Plato's cave that John Provorc is talking about, and he probably agrees with me. And maybe I have over-criticized or been over-critical here, maybe then to make a point. Then I'm all the happier. I want to hear what he has to say, and I want to be smarter, and I want to have a better view, and I think certainly details in the overall picture working on this idea of the nomadology. We're obviously fulfilling what Gilles Deleuze set out to do, you know, the greatest thinker of the 20th century. He created the term nomadology. He talked about the military, he talked about the shamans who could be nomads, but we're talking about the entire humanity has to become nomadic again to survive. And we know it for a fact. We go to the gym. You know, we all know that if we just lie in bed, we die from obesity. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're also discovering that, yeah, we look beautiful, we're sexually attractive when we're 20, but we know shit. You know, get the sex dolls in there and remind us that, well, that's what's easy. It was easy to look great, but it's damn hard work to be a fascinating and creative person who has wisdom. And that is what we must value again. We must, that must be the highest value. There we agree completely, all of us systemic thinkers. We agree on it's possible that I focus too much on the phallic because I don't see anybody
that was one of my questions. You anticipated one of my questions that people might interpret you as being sort of phallocentric or male centric or you know, people interpret your philosophy as that. I know you're not.
Being phallocentric means that if the men get their shit together, the women reap the benefits. They get more shoes.
Yeah. Oh.
So they can do their shit anyway. Giving birth to children, they do wonderfully. So, and they do so many other things. I mean, for God's sake, I've got tons of young girls that I'm mentor to right now, and I love them to bits. And we need female leaders because the men are not up to it.
Yeah.
The men have screwed up. So we certainly, during a long period now, need a lot of strong women taking leadership roles. But the magical perspective, and when I had one of these lovely, friendly conversations with John, and we talked through you in public, and then we talked in private directly, and I just told him straight off, I said, why don't you just come out as the screaming Buddhist you are? Because to me, John is the perfect Buddhist to match my Zoroastrianism.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be a Buddhist. He doesn't want to...
He is a Buddhist. Yeah. What else is he? He knows the Japanese. He knows the guys. He knows Tibet. He knows the Buddha. He's a formidable Buddhist scholar, and the sort of Plato's cave, the horizontal religion he's talking, the religion of the horizontal world that he's talking about. And he does it beautifully. I mean, for God's sake, I wrote the Synthesis book to celebrate guys like him. I don't have a problem with that at all. I'm just wanting to compliment the picture and say there's something lacking that could even be dangerous if we don't see it. And it's like, philosophically speaking, it's like, it's very common, but John has made the jump from Immanuel Kant straight to Heidegger. And then because Heidegger is a Nazi, he takes on the Christian Heidegger, who's Paul Tillich. And all those 50 lectures he gave arrived with putting Paul Tillich there as his bard absolute. So, okay, I don't do that. I think Kant was the last of the boy pharaohs. And it's Hegel who takes down Kant. And my God, when you start to understand how Hegel thinks, you understand what thinking is. And it's fantastic, and you get way more intelligent because of it, and you start to think negations and all that, and you get the picture. And you also get how misunderstood Hegel is, but he's brilliant. And his sons are Nietzsche, Freud, Marx, you know, Jung eventually. They're all sons of Hegel. If we hadn't started thinking negation, we couldn't even have discovered our own subconsciousness. Mm-hmm. You know? Hmm. We couldn't have the realizations we have today. It would have been impossible. That's where I'm at. So I think, I don't think you can jump to Heidegger, because it becomes a very individual existential project of some kind of self-indulgent self-transformation. That's where existentialism arises. I force people to go back out of the world. I remind you that the Zoroastrians don't like the monks and the nuns of the world. They don't like the people who sit there out in the forest, no hermits and all that. They say, no, you're part of society. And if you do walk out into the forest to retract, you only do it to see the world better.
Mm-hmm.
So you can come back and have a bigger view. You become a satellite. You see the bigger view. Then you come back into the village and you reunite with the village and you engage in your archetype and you do what you should do as a man or a woman to contribute to the tribe. This is Zoroastrianism.
Mm-hmm.
This is called Asha. Taoism does the same thing. It's called Tao.
Zen too, maybe the, you know, you come back to the marketplace with...
They're all the same. Zen in Japan, is Shan in China, is Thien in Vietnam, is Seon in Korea, is Dhyana in Zoroastrian Iran, and it's, no, it's Dhyana in Northern India, and it's Dhyana in Zoroastrian Iran. Dhyana and Dhyana. Dhyana in Zoroastrian Iran is the same thing. It's yoga, meditation, spiritual practice, martial arts. Here's where we agree completely with John Favarke. We need the resurrection of all these traditions. We got a team here in Sweden now in the spring, even working now, we're resurrecting the Zoroastrian martial arts, Zoroastrian yoga, Zoroastrian meditation. It's beautiful. And I love Synthism in the sense that I love this awakening of religious practices. I completely agree with John Favarke that religion comes from underneath and its practices. Yeah. But then you cannot escape politics. You cannot say that you cannot create a religion where you pretend sex does not exist. You cannot create a religion where you pretend violence does not exist. You cannot create a religion where you don't, where you pretend art does not exist, which leaves you ambivalent. So those things must exist and they must be included. And a real religion, if you're going to make a clean break of Christianity and create a proper religion, a real religion would definitely include and we try to domesticate, but also celebrate the forces of sex and art and violence. Mm-hmm. That's when the phallus is included in religion, which means the church and state cannot be separate. A proper religion understands that all of society is religious, and church and state going separate ways is exactly what creates a state that is irresponsible and then plunders the planet, which is exactly what the European states did.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is the way to contain the forces of nature, to contain the forces of nature inside ourselves.
Mm.
That's Hegel's, that's Freud's, that's Jung's point.
Mm-hmm. I have this image of the two rivers coming to my head again.
Yeah, that's a very strong image. Again, I got to credit Peter Towson and my team for that. He's good. He's good. Mm-hmm. He's really good with that. Proud to work in the team, collaborated, wonderful guy. It's so striking. You know, it's like you read Marshall McLuhan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that the way we communicate determines how we think.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's Aristotle. We talked about an Aristotelian revival now for a long time. It's really happening. If you're radical enough, you take Aristotle's critique of Plato, what he tells Plato, you don't understand context. And if you don't understand the context within which things happen, you don't understand anything.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Aristotelian revival is all about rediscovering context. The radical way of doing that, now we have access to the last 10,000 years of history, and we have access actually to genetically to human beings for the last 200,000 years. We can finally, scientifically, through data anthropology, understand human beings. That is fantastic if you're an Aristotelian, because then you can study how the landscape we live in shape our thinking. And can you see now why exactly Akhenaten happened in Egypt and why Zoroaster happened in Mesopotamia?
Mm-hmm. So
that little shift made all the difference
between the one river civilization and the two river civilization.
And theology has argued ever since about the trinities, you know, about the dualities, about what is the Father, what is the Son. What is the rain god? What is the sun god? What is the split within the phallus? I want to go deeply into this, and I intend to call it phallus theory and phallus studies. And I don't mean that as a medical doctor. I mean that as a philosopher. what are different aspects of phallus? I mean, there's the root of the phallus, that's the history, that's deep history where we come from, and there's the phallus in the sense that the phallus is the dream where we're going. I think we need a great, a grand new narrative, at least for a small elite that can then set an example that others can follow. That's the Nietzschean perspective. Or hopefully, if it's possible, some kind of collaboration between man and machine that creates a sustainable world that actually is interesting to live in.
Interesting,
The name for that is Fraso Kereti in Avesta, in ancient Iranian. Mm-hmm. We're going to live in a world of permanent change from now on. There are no options. That's what's going to happen. Now, if that's what's happening now, then no methodology, obviously, the term we use. The barred absolute is what we're up against. Mm-hmm. And this is probably then the book about the last of all exoduses, or the last exodus or whatever. We don't know that. It's certainly an exodus book. But to all you listeners out there, if you want to contribute and collaborate with us, we don't know where the exodus is going. We don't have the name for the state of permanent change. Well, we obviously have the Zoroastrians' names for it. That's what we use those words, Farash Karati and the Haruvatat. But we don't have a gutsy, ballsy name that works in the English language or in European languages that says where we're going. New Babylon is the wrong metaphor. Jerusalem is over. And Babylon's over. And urbanization is over. Well, geography is over. Space is dying, even in physics. We live in a very concentrated world. You know, it's just fascinating. But we don't have a name for that yet. We have all those terminology, the phallic gaze, the barred absolute, nomadology. The terms are there, the Deleuzean, the Hegelian, all that. Psychoanalytical, certainly. Some of these bright kids out there who go all the way through and listen through all these sessions we do, you and I, and find the depth in them that's there.
I think the audience is slowly growing. It's bigger on the, now in the podcast than it is on the YouTube, I noticed.
Good. So they can stop looking at my red nose and actually hear what I'm saying.
Well, it's about almost equal.
But you're handsome, you know. If they favor you, they would look on YouTube. And Kennedy will win the election. If they favor me, they will listen to the radio. And Nixon will win the election.
No, not true.
Yes.
You have a beard. You have a great beard.
Usually.
And you're pretty damn handsome.
Last few months. Andrew, you can tell you live in France. You're handsome. You and I are going to be traveling a lot this year, doing stuff together.
Yeah.
We plan to go to Canada together. We love Toronto. We love all the shit that's going on there, and see what we can make out of that.